Spirituals are a distinctly American form of music, and they tell us a lot about the people who first sang them and the times they lived in. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me are Jeanette Thompson, professor of voice at the UW-Madison, and pianist Thomas Kasdorf, as well as percussionist Garrett Mendelow.
They brought three very important contributions to our music world. They brought communal dance, call and response, and polyrhythms.
From Africa.
Yes. that song has become the national anthem for South Africa. And the tune was written by Enoch Sontonga. and I sang it in the Zulu language. The Zulus were the indigenous people of South Africa. But not many of the slaves, actually, that were brought to this country were brought from South Africa. They were brought from the western part of Africa, like Ghana and Nigeria, mainly when they came.
Raises an interesting question right away, though, Jeanette, and that is, we're calling this a spiritual?
Yes.
It seems to fit all the criteria to me.
Correct.
But we think of spirituals as being traditional songs, and yet it is still possible to write one.
Correct, correct. Well, here's the thing, is that the original idea of the spirituals, okay, the original ideas were was when the slaves came to this country, they were put into the fields to work. Now, they weren't allowed to talk to each other, but they were allowed to sing whenever they wanted to, because the slave owners loved hearing the slaves sing. So they would make up songs. The songs later became a way of sending messages throughout the fields. So if you can imagine, there are these giant fields, and if you want to get a message when you're not allowed to speak, if you sing it, then this field might start singing, and then that field would hear it, and they would join in and sing. So slaves would sing things, particularly later on. When they first were brought to this country, you know, they were just finding ways to make music for themselves. And as I said at the beginning of this song, the three important aspects of music that they brought was communal dance. And we don't even think of communal dance as being something that came from Africa, but it actually is. And call and response, which everyone sees and hears in churches all the time, that came from Africa. It was part of their ritual. And then, of course, polyrhythms. But the interesting thing about polyrhythms is the Africans used to love to communicate with drums in the fields. And when the British and the Portuguese and all the people who came to discover Africa, as it were, or to find sources within Africa.
It had been
Africa.
Found before that.
Right, exactly. But
it was their discovery.
But they felt as if they had discovered it. But anyway, when they came, they heard all of this noise in the bushes, and they thought it was just chaotic noise going on. And then a musicologist was along once and said, wait a minute, listen to those rhythms. You can't notate those rhythms. And before polyrhythms was infused into our world, the only rhythms that we had was 2-4, 4-4, and 3-4 time. And then when polyrhythms came along, this is how we're able to have contemporary music with time signatures like 7-8 and 5-4 and 3-1. And this is how we have rap music and pop music and all of that, because of the polyrhythm. The rhythm is the big thing. They told stories that they had heard about the Bible, right? So,
right.
But they would hear these stories from, like, the slave owner's children or a wife or something like that. And so they didn't always get the stories straight. And you can be singing a spiritual and you'll see some strange wording, but it's the original wording that people had. So, but these spirituals became like a key component for so many things. So as when the Underground Railroad was established, so the slaves were brought here in 1619.
Yeah,
that's when they started
by the Dutch.
Being brought here. So once they were brought here, they figured out that, okay, we can't talk, but we can sing to each other. So if you need to get a message across, we'll just put it in a song. So if they were singing something like, there's a spiritual called Steal Away.
Sure.
Okay, so if someone sang that, that meant tonight is the night that we're going to try and escape. Wade in the water meant meet by the lake, meet by the water. I don't feel no ways tired. That's another spiritual. That's an encouragement one to don't give up, that it's going to be okay. But they would send messages to each other through these songs. But if you can imagine that, you know, they're working in the field all day under this hot sun, and they must have been just horrifically tired. And so the thought of then that night having a meeting to try to defy the slave owners, because, of course, if they were captured, they would be killed instantly. So this was a really, really big thing. And then they ran into abolitionists who were quite helpful and would help them plan escape routes and things like that. So the spiritual not only was a way of uplifting your soul, like on Sundays, but it was also, it became a means of how to communicate, most importantly.
Well, maybe it's a digression and maybe not, but there is this one instance of a spiritual that is said to have come actually from classical music rather than the other way around. So what's the story on going home?
I love this story because in order to tell this story, I have to give a little bit of background. And that is that Harry Burley was a young composer from Philadelphia, and his mother was a slave. And he wanted to attend the university in New York, and this is in 1892. It just happened to be the time that Dvorak decided to leave Czechoslovakia and come to New York. And so Harry Burley, there's two stories about Harry Burley that I'd like to tell. Both of them are quite nice. One of them is that when he came to New York, he needed a job. And so there was a very big church, which ended up being my church, funny enough, called St. George's Episcopal. And it was an aristocratic church. So we're talking about 1892. They weren't about to have a colored person be a soloist in that church. So, but he saw there was an advertisement for a baritone. So he went to sing for the audition. And the organist went to the head of the vestry. And the vestry is the governing body of the Episcopal Church. And the head of the vestry in 1892 was J.P. Morgan.
It's getting interesting.
I know. And so the organist went to J.P. Morgan and said, I heard a baritone today. And and J.P. Morgan said, well, what's the problem? He said, I'm afraid that if I hire him, he said he's a colored man, and if I hire him, I'm afraid that people will leave the church. And so J.P. Morgan said, is he the best man for the job? And the organist said, yes, he is. He said, then hire him, and for every member that leaves the church, I will pay what they were paying to the church.
And he could afford to, but
it was a grand gesture
anyway. Yeah,
I know.
For sure, yeah.
But you never hear good stories about J.P. Morgan.
They are fairly rare. That's true.
Yes.
But this is a charming, warm human story about J.P. Morgan.
I know. Okay, but now getting back to Dvorak. So Dvorak, so in addition to being soloist at St. George's, Harry Burley got a job as a janitor at the new school, the New Amsterdam, I forgot the name of it, but it is what is now Juilliard, but it was the conservatory in New York at that time. So he got a job as a janitor. And as he was working, he was humming these songs. So Dvorak heard him humming these songs and said, what is this music you're humming? And he said, oh, it's just songs my mother taught me. And he said, well, sing some for me. Sing some to me. And he said, no, they're work songs. Really, you don't want to hear these because these are just songs that bring back pain. And Dvorak said, no, sing them for me. So Harry Burley did. And Dvorak was fascinated by the tunes. He was fascinated by the motifs that are used in the spirituals. And he couldn't get enough of them. And he said to Harry Burley, you should write these down. And he said, but why? He said, because if you don't, then future generations will not know about these songs. And so Burley said, yeah, but I don't want to write these songs. And he said, but if you don't, who will? Because you're a young composer and you should. Anyway, and I got all this information from Harry Burley's niece.
Oh.
Yeah, so I feel like it was a reliable source. Anyway, and so this is how we have spirituals that are notated today. And Dvorak was so fascinated by these tunes that when he wrote his New World Symphony, he used these tunes from the spirituals. And this next song, Going Home, is an example where you can see all the influence of the spiritual in his music.
A lot of people in this country did expect or hope that Dvorak would guide them toward an American music, and he said something to the effect of, well, the way to do that would be to tap into those spirituals. So, yes, he was indeed influenced by and inspired by the spirituals that he heard in this country in the 1890s. I want to maybe slip back a little further into the history of spirituals when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Jeanette Thompson, and along with her vocal performances, we're also hearing the piano played by Thomas Kasdorf and percussion provided by Garrett Mendelow. And we've heard about the influence of, let's say, classical music in terms of making maybe a little bit better known some of the spirituals, some American sounds via the New World Symphony of Dvorak. Before that, that would have been in the early 1890s and years following. Before that, There was an ensemble credited with really making spirituals known to the American public, we'll just say white America in particular, the Fisk Jubilee Singers.
Yes, yes, that is correct. In 1866, there was a man named Clinton B. Fisk, and he himself was an abolitionist. The real definition of an abolitionist is anyone who detests the thought of bondage or slavery. Okay. So he started a school, and the name of the school was called the Fisk Freed Colored School, because there were schools all up and down the East Coast, you know, for white people, but there were not schools for black people.
And this is in Nashville, was it?
Nashville, correct. So this is, which is in the Deep South, where all of the slavery really existed. Okay, so he put together a bunch of teachers and said, okay, he had an endowment to give to the school, but he didn't have a lot of money. This is all relevant, by the way. Hang in there with me there, Norman.
<I'm hanging. laughs>
So he had an endowment for the school. So he put together teachers who were willing to give their time, because many of them didn't get paid. They taught for free. Because the people who attended this Fisk Freed Colored School were ex-slaves. So they had no money. They had none. So one of the people that agreed to teach was George Leonard White. And George Leonard White is actually quite important to the world of spirituals as we know it, and I'll tell you why. So the school, you can imagine, in 1866, the school is full of ex-slaves. Teachers are not being paid because there is no money. So the school is always in trouble of having to fold because there's no money. So George White says, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put together a group of 10 singers, and we'll go out and try to raise some money for the school. So Clinton Fisk said, well, that's a good idea. Let's try that. Now, so what George White did was he tried to teach them classical songs and, you know, like motets and madrigals and things like this. But he threw in some Stephen Foster. Okay, let's not go there. Anyway, so he threw in, because Stephen Foster were easy pieces to sing.
And popular.
And popular during this time. Anyway, they got nowhere. And they would go to venues and people wouldn't show up. And they kept trying to tour in this country, and the singers had to sleep in barns because people wouldn't let them in the buildings, and they had nowhere to stay, and it was just horrid. So then he had gotten an invitation to bring these singers to a convention. So he took the singers to this convention, and no one was listening to them sing. So there was a lull, and one of the singers in the group started singing Steal Away. Now, as part of the African call and response tradition, you would never allow a singer to be singing and not join in. So they all joined in with natural harmonies. And all of a sudden, everyone in the convention stopped, and they thought, what on earth? So when they finished singing this, George White said, Where did you get this? And they said, well, these are work songs. He said, why haven't I heard about these work songs? And he said, do you have any more? He said, well, we have plenty. He said, I'll tell you what I want you to do. I want you all to go home and talk to your parents and get all of the songs that you can gather up. And they all came back, and he made harmonies for the group to sing these songs. And this is how the choral arrangements of these songs got started. This is how it all... So, and then they started concertizing in this country and Europe. So then he got passages on ships to go to Europe, and they raised all kinds of money. They raised, in their first tour, $150,000, which is equivalent
yes.
to $4 million today.
Yeah, spectacular.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, of course, now, even today, this group still exists. The Fisk Jubilee Singers still exist.
They do indeed, yes.
At Fisk University. I think the main thing that everyone wanted to convey is that the spiritual, thanks to people like the Jubilee Singers and Dvorak, belongs in the classical realm of music, not to be confused with gospel music.
Right.
Gospel music is a pop realm of music. It does not belong in the spiritual realm of music. And so there were people who came out of that tradition, like William L. Dawson, who was really, he taught at Tuskegee Institute, and he was connected with Fisk University. And there were four of them who ended up in New York and actually were friends with Harry Burley, who was the student of Dvorak.
Was R. Nathaniel Dett one of those four?
Correct. Yeah. Nathaniel Dett was one.
Also toured Europe.
Yes. Edward Boatner was one. Hall Johnson was one. And William L. Dawson. And so they benefited from the knowledge that Burley learned from Dvorak in their writing. But if you listen to their arrangements of spirituals, they took it back to a much more simplistic way, which I happen to prefer. I prefer the simplistic way because my great-grandmother was a slave. And my grandmother used to sing these songs to me, and so they're in my ear. And when I made my recordings, I went by what I grew up knowing, you see. And it was a whole tradition. And the slaves, went, particularly in church, is they couldn't read music, but they would write as best they could the words. And at the front, at the beginning of the page, they would put a big C for common time, or they put a slash through it for cut time. And now they would put the C with a slash, and you would automatically know that it was something fast, like, you know, that good news. I got a crown up in the kingdom, you know, that good news, you know, immediately. And everybody would just do that, you see. But so this book got passed down. It was this black book, and my grandmother ended up with that book. And I remember looking at that book, and she would, you know, tell me about these songs. It was really pretty great.
Well, you must think, at least I would think so, that these earlier, simpler arrangements, if you want to call them that, or traditions, would have more emotional impact, perhaps, than the more dressed-up versions of later.
Exactly.
Anyway, getting them out there was the main thing.
And was
whatever,
the main
whatever
thing.
Variety.
Yes. And to get them out there in a way that you wouldn't think of them as a taboo type of music.
Right.
Because you see, the slaves themselves didn't want to sing them anymore because they were ex-slaves, so they didn't want to sing these songs that they used to sing in the fields. But in fact, it's such great music that if it had not been for people like Leonard White and Dvorak, we wouldn't have this music today. We literally would not have it.
Yes, because they had to make it to be written down and then shortly after recorded.
That's right. That's right. And so then the four who were friends with Burley that I mentioned earlier, they took it on and then they got their music published and it's why we have it today, you see.
You have a medley now.
I do. And the first one, Hall Johnson actually recorded it. I do my own arrangement of it, but he recorded it. And then I have A City Called Heaven, which is Edward Boatner, is one of his arrangements. Oh, go home to my Lord and be free. Pilgrim of sorrow, I'm tossed in this wide world alone. No hope have I for tomorrow. Started to make heaven my home. Sometimes I am tossed and driven along. Sometimes I don't know where to I've heard of a city called heaven, and I've started to make it my own. My mother has reached that pure glory. My father still walking in sin. My sisters and brothers won't own me because I am trying to get in. I've heard of that city called heaven, and I've started to make it my home. No. No more.
Often is that done, that you meld spirituals and then a Yiddish song by Meyer Finkelstein? It worked, but it was a little bit of a curveball there.
Do you know why I did that? Because here's the thing, that we're all descendants, really, of Abraham, aren't we? And so, I don't know, it's a beautiful piece of music, and listen to what this song actually means. To all generations, we will make known your greatness. To all eternity, proclaim your holiness. Your praise, O God, shall never depart from our lips. You are the sovereign, almighty, and holy. Blessed is God, the Holy One. I'm sorry, to me, that is a spiritual. To me, I believe it belongs in that group. Of course, this is all my doing. This is not...
not the way they sang it in the 19th century. But
no. And this is what happens when you get a little old. You get to do whatever you want because people just think you're cantankerous anyway. So,
back with Jeanette Thompson and Spirituals when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. Thank you. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Jeanette Thompson, and we're looking into the world, the wellsprings, you might even say, of the spiritual, which leads us into various musical directions. You mentioned fairly early on, Jeanette, that gospel is not spirituals. I get that, but how do you make the distinction then, and what is the relationship between the two?
The stories, particularly in the spirituals, that the original spirituals from the fields, they were stories that they heard from the Old Testament.
Right.
But the composers tried very hard to distinguish that the spirituals belonged in the realm of classical music, because gospel music, you don't need a trained voice to sing it. You just have to have a will and a voice and go for it, Now, I'm not putting gospel music down, because gospel music is quite wonderful. I love listening to it. I can't sing it so well, but I love listening to it. And and it certainly has its place. And gospel music is how you reach so many young people as well, because they like the beat and they like the consistency of it, feeling popular.
Well, let me throw another one at you then. How about the blues? Relationship between spirituals and the blues?
Yeah. Actually, I can tell you this, Norman, that when music began in this country, the music all came from somewhere else. But once the slaves were ensconced in this country, the spiritual is the only music that we can actually claim as our own. We can't claim any other form of music.
Right.
Now, out of the spiritual came the blues, like the St. Louis blues, and then came jazz, and then came all of these other forms of music, like the pop music that we know. And it was all from the rhythms. The rhythms is what got people always, the rhythms. And in fact, there's a style of music that dates all the way back, called the Old Baptist Lined Hymns. Mm-hmm. And the Old Baptist Lined Hymns, it is accredited as being started in Ohio, but I don't think that's really true. There were a lot of people from Kentucky who were migrating toward the Midwest, to Ohio, from the South.
Sure.
And I personally believe that that's how the Old Baptist Line Hymn got formed, from the Kentuckians who migrated to Ohio. But the Old Baptist Line Hymn is the call and response that I've spoken of, whereas one person would sing a line, and then you would repeat the line, because there was only one book.
And this comes from Africa.
This comes from Africa. It's not accredited as coming from Africa, but of course it does come from Africa. But there was a book. There was a book, and you would sing this line, and then everybody would sing along. And so the tradition of hymns actually came out of the songs that these people would come to church and sing. And so you find all kinds of hymns. For example, Lift Every Voice and Sing is known as the national black anthem. Now, I don't know if nowadays people know that, but when I grew up, we called it the Negro National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. And whenever you heard it, you would stand just as you would if you heard the Star Spangled Banner. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now it is in all the hymn books as well. So it's amazing how the traditions sort of shift, you see. Which brings us to the hymn that was my mother's favorite song, which is His Eye is on the Sparrow. And I have such a memory of being about 14 or 15 years old. By then, I knew that singing was going to be my thing. And I can still recall the day that my mother came and put her arms around me and she said, "Now, when I die, I want you to sing this song for me. This is my song." And then when she died, I couldn't do it.
Understandable.
Yeah. But I like to sing it as often as possible. It's a hymn that I've turned into a concert piece, and I love the song, and I don't care that it's a hymn.
Well, hymns can play very nicely in concerts.
Yes, it does, actually.
Ever since Marian Anderson, Leontine Price, let's say.
That's right. Marian Anderson in particular. She sang any kind of hymn she wanted to. And nobody cared. Because you just liked hearing her sing.
Here we go.
Discouraged. Why should the shadows come? Why should my heart be lonely and long for heaven and home? Jesus is my portion, my constant friend is He. His eyes on the sparrow, and I me. His eyes on the sparrow, and I know He watches me. I sing because watch it.
Well, we started early on, Jeanette, with talking about code in songs, tips as to how to perhaps escape slavery, and that would certainly be seem to be the case with Wade in the Water. That's a great way to escape the dogs, to throw them off the scent.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Yeah.
And so we'll add this as our finale.
This song was arranged by a professor from Prairie View University in Texas named John Cornelius, Wade in the Water.
He's coming.